I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. What's the right habitat for nurturing and hatching new ideas? John Halkins has spent a lifetime answering that question. His earlier work documented the rise of the creative economy, and his latest book, Creative Ecologies, proposes a new approach to making a supportive environment for creativity and ideas. And Rod Franz was on the forefront of developing the creative class movement, but now he and his wife Marcy have turned their attention from the creative class to creative families. They've written a book called The Yes Child, and we'll talk to them about what it means to build a family culture. All that, plus the news from Plan Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith, coming up on today's Smart City, right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Innovative ideas are the currency of a successful economy, and John Halkins has been in the forefront of how to produce those ideas. He is, among other things, an author, lecturer, consultant, and television producer. But his latest book, Creative Ecologies, attempts to navigate how ideas are spawned and how their creation and use are accelerated under the right conditions. Your earlier work, The Creative Economy, had such widespread impact. How does your new book, Creative Ecologies, build on that earlier work?
It's a much broader, much bigger canvas that I'm working on now. The first book, Creative Economy, was really looking at the way that businesses operate in the new economy, in the new world. Whereas Creative Ecology is looking at everybody, both those working within business and those working not within business, and seeing how they have ideas. And the reason I did that was that it became clear to me in recent years that, in fact, the way that people have ideas is happening throughout the entire society, and the business part of it is only actually a very small part of it.
So tell me a little more about the creative ecology, this concept that you have.
I was looking at theories of creativity and innovation and creative industries and what Richard Florida calls creative class and creative cities. And I was looking around for some common denominator that would be applicable in all circumstances. And I wanted to see if the science of ecology, which is a pretty well-tried and robust science, could help us to understand the ways in which everybody, as an individual in a group, has ideas and works with other people to develop those ideas. So I found that, in fact, ecology was a very, very relevant way of helping us to understand how we have ideas and how we share them in society.
You say that each of us has the ability to be creative, the innate sense as human beings to be creative. How does a city think about adding value to each person's creativity, recognizing that each person is creative, and then helping them add value to that?
The most important way in which city planners can help people to be creative is to provide spaces, organizations, networks, institutions for them to enjoy their creativity and exercise their creativity. This probably starts in the school, because the school is where we pick up our habits, some good habits, some bad habits. And the way in which we relate to our teachers, the way our teachers relate to us, the way we relate to our peers in our age group is very important. So when I'm asked by city planners what they should do, I say they should teach learning. They should do it both in the schoolroom and they should do it out of the schoolroom. Learning and education is where people learn how to be creative.
You talk in your book about three principles of creative ecologies. Tell me more about those.
These are borrowed from the science of ecology. The first is diversity. We know from Darwin and biological evolution that we need diversity. And it's the same with ecology. We need to live in an environment that is diverse in terms of ethnic races, in terms of color, in terms of language and linguistics, in terms of the way people organize themselves. We need that diversity. We also need technically to have a very rapid rate of change. We then need learning. I think learning is probably the most important factor. And here we're moving completely away from Darwin. There's some aspects of the ecology in which Darwin is applicable, and very importantly so. And there's some where Darwin is not wrong, but he's silent. Darwin does not talk about learning, does not talk about what we call acquired characteristics. Learning is the most important of the four. I often think that creative people have something in them that propels them to go on learning through their entire life, not just when they are at school and college, but throughout their entire life. And in fact, when a creative person just stops learning, stops trying to think of things differently, stops thinking of ways of how to improve what they're doing, then they stop being creative. And the fourth is adaptation, which is using what you've learned to change the way you behave. So it's diversity, change, learning, and adaptation.
Let's talk about learning for a minute, because as you said earlier, learning occurs both in school, but it also occurs outside of school. And increasingly with access to the web, there is a formality, an odd formality to learning outside of schooling. And I've often thought of cities as learning environments, and if as natural learning environments, and were you to make a city a learning environment with intent, if that were your intent, what would you do? Have you ever, John, considered that intention? Have you ever moved with that intention or even thought about it in the life of a city, how you could make that into a learning environment or even a learning lab for people?
Yes, I trained as a urban designer at a rather remarkable school called the Architectural Association, which is a very democratic organization where everybody there was fascinated by the possibilities of designing buildings and the built environment. And I've been very lucky. I went to schools, I went to universities, I went to that architectural school where learning about oneself, learning about what one wanted to do in order to do it better, learning in order to achieve very high standards has very much been part of my life. And I cannot imagine living a life in a different way. It seems to me that while the numbers of people that are going to formal education, including college, have increased only slowly in the last 20, 30 years, the opportunities for informal education, informal learning, have increased exponentially. And I have a film company and I have a consultancy company, both of them based in London. And everybody in those two companies wants to learn. If they don't learn by what they're doing, I don't mean learning in, like going away for an hour and learning. I mean learning by observing what it is that they're doing and striving all the time to do it differently, more conveniently, better, in ways that gives them pleasure.
You explore the idea in your book of a tipping point, and you distinguish when we simply have that point at which we simply have a network of creative people and that point at which that evolves into a creative ecology. What are the conditions necessary to get past the point of a network of creative people and develop an actual creative ecology?
This is a very interesting question. And it occurred to me as I was speaking to people in many different countries and cities about my first book that the one question everybody wanted to ask was, is my city a creative city, and how can we become a creative city? And in many cases, these were cities that either were, in my view, already very creative, or in no way were going to get creative. There comes, as you say, a tipping point where a city becomes a creative city. Where in London, for instance, if you apply for a job or you set yourself up in business and you sort of think you can get away by copying other people, you will just fail. You will not get hired. Or if you get hired by mistake, you will be out the door very quickly because you will be found to be an obstruction to everybody else around you. And nowadays, cities like London and New York, which I know well, both of them, are, to my mind, creative cities. Whether the percentage is actually whatever, it doesn't matter. The atmosphere, the mood at all levels of the city, from individuals at home, families, schools, small companies, big companies, city government, the mood is continually to strive for ways in which things can be done better. Now, this is not necessarily a recipe for happiness, because you can get too much creativity, you can get too much innovation, such that you never actually achieve the sorts of things that the society as a whole wishes for.
And how do you reach that tipping point?
On my experience, you need two things. You need a politician who says that thinking for yourself and creativity is critically important. Now, having said that, the politicians should not fool themselves that they're going to have much impact on the way in which business operates. But they'll send a very important message, not only to the people working in business, but absolutely critically, in my experience, to the mothers and the fathers of the people working in business. Because if kids coming out of college say, I want to be a designer, I want to work in fashion, I want to become a journalist, I want to do web design, I have a crazy idea, and I sort of think it's worth exploring for 6 months or a year, or and I'm not going to get a job because I want to do something else. In this country, and in most countries, a few generations ago, people have said, don't do that. My father said to me, get a proper job. He wanted me to go work in the oil business. What happened in this country 10 years ago was the government said creative industries are critical to the future of our economy. Parents were reassured that getting a job in design, getting a job in fashion, getting a job in digital media was not some wacky, unsustainable, and slightly second-class activity, but was actually central to the future of the country. And that was a fantastic message to go around. That was the next thing, the second thing that you need is when those people have begun to set up their businesses, you need marketplaces where they can become sustainable. This is something that America is very, very good at. America has, of all countries in the world, the most get-up-and-go, business-minded group of people. And so it is possible for someone to start a company and through being moderately clever, moderately smart, very hardworking, to make a success of that business. In many countries, however well-intentioned you are and however hard you work, it is very difficult. In America, it is relatively easy. And that's that possibility of success is cumulative. The more you succeed, the more you succeed, and the more you succeed, the more other people will succeed. And that's the second most important factor.
I want to come back to this messaging part of what's necessary to reach the tipping point, because you specifically referenced the government sending a strong message that jobs in design were okay. Jobs in design were very much needed. But you also say that every person is creative, and there are ways in which a creativity can manifest itself in any job, even jobs that sound dull or are more traditional jobs. How do we communicate or inculcate this notion that creativity can also manifest itself in more traditional jobs and should manifest itself in more traditional jobs?
I think that's a really profound question, and my answer is that it's really difficult to do that. Maybe particularly here, but But I think also actually in America, and I think in Canada and the rest of Europe, there is still this feeling that creativity is only valuable or only permissible in certain sectors. And you can say, well, you know, a designer, an artist, a sculptor, a poet, a writer, they are living purely off of their ability to express themselves or to draw or to use their aesthetic. And that is fundamentally different from running a retail operation or whatever. And I would say, well, it sort of is, yes, if you contrast the designer and, say, the guy that is running the checkout or the warehousing. But if you look at the way a distribution chain works now or a retail chain works now, you see that they actually are using design and aesthetic at every step of that. I was working recently with Penguin Books, which is a very, in a sense, traditional and very well-established publisher. The way they are now using design to enhance the networks that they want to set up to relate writers to users is pretty similar to the way in which a social network might use designers to enhance those relationships. And I've been involved in meetings both in China and in Europe where farmers and agricultural companies have also been working with designers to set up networks between their producers and their consumers. So I think that although, in a sense, the artist is the pure creative person, if you're running any supply chain, you're running any network, you need and you can be just as creative. I think that's a very important point, and we should not pretend that the world is separated into people that are creative and people that are not creative.
Are there cities that you would cite as epitomizing a creative ecology? Do you see creative ecologies existing?
Yes, I do. I see London as composed of, in a sense, one big citywide ecology and a lot of other ecologies in different sectors. New York and LA, I know them from experience to be creative in that way. I go to Cannes for the film festival and TV festival, advertising festival. Cannes is not a creative city. People parachute in and have fun and whatever. They don't parachute out, but they fly out again. Shanghai, where I spend a lot of my time, is not as a whole city a creative place, but it is very aware that if it is going to step up and become a world-class city, it is going to have to become a creative city. And there are certainly businesses and big pockets of activity in Shanghai.
Let's stick with Shanghai. That's a great example of a city where you say there are pockets where a creative ecology exists or creativity exists. There is intent. There's recognition that this is important. So what do they do? What does a city do to move to make itself a creative ecology?
I have a sort of mantra of three principles. The first is everybody is creative, and the second is creativity needs freedom. That creativity needs freedom to express itself. And the third of which is that freedom needs markets to express itself. Shanghai has people that are individually very creative, and I do believe that the Chinese are genetically and culturally as creative as anybody else. But they do not have the freedom, and they do not have the markets. And I can see individuals, I can see companies in Shanghai, and this is the same for other Chinese cities, that are very constricted by market structures that do not reward initiative and entrepreneurial behavior in many sectors. In some sectors they do, and in some sectors they do not. And while those market structures are in place, then China will find it very difficult to become the kind of fully fledged, complete, 100% creative economy that I'm talking about.
Are those the main challenges or barriers to this idea of the creative ecology being taken up in cities? You mentioned freedom and market structures that don't reward creativity and entrepreneurship.
Yes, yes. You have to have freedom to express yourself, and you have to have freedom to express yourself in ways that may appear rather weird or new and novel and maybe rather shocking, and that people maybe can't understand, or if they like, if they do understand, they don't like. You have to have that freedom. That freedom does not exist in China, because although you can be very creative in China, and people are very creative in China, you're only really allowed to develop your ideas and to raise money for them and get resources for them if it could be shown to have a social benefit. Whereas in the West, we sort of don't care about social benefit. We let that work itself out. If we have an idea, it may be completely wacky and weird. It's okay. Over to you. That's great. Off you go. Good luck. In Asia, it's very different. And then secondly, the markets are not functioning as they should do in order to support that free expression and that free interchange of the goods and services that would follow from that free expression.
You end your book with some thoughts on what you call the new billion, the billion young people looking for their first job. Do you have any advice, John, for city leaders eager to capture the attention of this talent pool and attract that talent pool to their cities?
The billion people that I keep in mind are people that are looking for their first job. And now they don't just look for jobs, they look for places where they can have fun, learn. I come back to this again, it's terribly important, where they can learn, meet with all sorts of people, meet famous people, meet people that are really good at their job. If they're a good designer, they want to go to a place where there are other good designers. They want to go and meet the best designers they can meet. So there's a snowball effect, which is very good for places like London. It's not so good if you're struggling, because people want to leave you and go to the best places, whether it's London, Barcelona, Milan, Turin, Rome. So the city leaders can do a limited amount to encourage that. It's very hard for a city leader to say, I want to have one or two or three or four or five of the world's best architects living in my city. It's very hard. There was a very interesting proposal in Detroit last year by a private foundation working with the city to award prizes. It was a very visionary idea. They just said, we'll put down money and we will give it to people who we want to give it to attract them to come and live in the city for 1 to 5 years. And there was cash on the table, and there was cheap housing, and there was tax holidays. And it was a very attractive package. That is sort of what you have to do. You have to make it somewhere where people want to go, where people want to go from the suburbs into the city center, from the countryside into the suburbs, from other countries into the city center. And it's a mix of companies and colleges, not so much universities, but specialist colleges, where young people think, that's where I want to go.
John, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
It was good to talk to you. Thank you.
John Halkins is the author of Creative Ecologies, Where Thinking is a Proper Job. He joined us from his office in London. And now for the latest in the world of urban planning and design, we turn to Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
In the progressive San Francisco Bay Area, there's an uncomfortable contradiction. Some environmentalists there have also been playing the role of NIMBYs, arguing against any new development. This opposition is instead pushing development out and exacerbating sprawl, destroying the very green and open space the environmentalists cherish. As the cities of Berkeley and Oakland debate new downtown plans, residents are coming to realize that they can be NIMBYs or environmentalists, but not both. As explained in a recent article from the East Bay Express, factions within these cities have been tussling about if and where more dense development should go. But as plans approach approval stage, it appears that the development averse environmentalists are moving past their NIMBY ways to cautiously embrace the idea of density. And out in Boston, filling potholes just got a lot easier. The city has unveiled a new piece of technology that allows residents to photograph minor urban nuisances like potholes and busted streetlights and send them directly to the city through their iPhones. According to an article from the Boston Globe, the application enables people to send in photos equipped with geographic data telling officials the exact location of the problem. In return, they get a tracking number to monitor when or if the problem gets fixed. Like many cities, Boston currently has a telephone hotline that people can call to report problems, but many have complained that their requests seem to disappear into the bureaucratic jungle, never to be heard from again or resolved. As a result, the phone system is not very popular. City officials are hoping the modern iPhone approach will elicit more participation from the public about where problems exist. Whether the city actually solves those problems people report is another matter. And finally, during this recession, small-town America isn't exactly in the best shape. Jobs are drying up, homes are being abandoned, and city budgets are evaporating in the summer sun. But that stereotype doesn't fall across the board. A recent piece from the Planning Commissioner's Journal looked at the downtown success of Niles, Michigan, a town of about 12,000 just shy of the state's southern border with Indiana. Failed urban renewal programs in the 70s led to the eventual abandonment of the city's Main Street business district. Downtown vacancies were at 25% in 2000, but then the city started doing outreach, meeting one-on-one with local business people and investors, delivering the message that the community would support downtown businesses if only they were there. That message, it seems, has sunken in. Over the past 5 years, 46 new downtown businesses have opened, and Niles officials are optimistic for the future, even in uncertain times. For Planetizen, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of Planetizen.com. Coming up after the break, from creative ecologies to creative families, we'll speak with Rod and Marcy Franz about their new book, The Yes Child. You're listening to Smart City. And a special welcome to our podcast listeners. You've heard us talk about our social networking site, My City, and the community there has been booming. Hundreds of listeners, just like you, have joined the site and are talking and collaborating on all the issues that mean the most to people who love cities. Want to join? Send us an email to our producer, Scotty, at smartcityradio.com, and he'll get you signed up. I look forward to seeing you online, and now back to the show. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Rod Franz was a key player in building and branding the Richard Florida Creativity Group, and he's been a tireless advocate for the creative class movement. But he's also a husband and a father, and now he and his wife, Marcy, have turned their attention teaching others how to build the culture of a family. Rod and Marcy join us to talk about their book, The Yes Child. All right, your book is called The Yes Child. Are you simply the most permissive parents in the world, or is there something else behind the title?
No, we are not the most permissive parents. And in fact, what we really meant by it, and what we mean by it, is having an attitude of affirmation and positivity and openness. And like when somebody makes a really great play in a sporting event and you go, yes. So that's really what it means. It's not the saying of the word yes. It's about the being of the word.
How does affirmation benefit a child and a parent-child relationship?
Let me answer that question by asking you a question. Did you see, it was in a lot of the newspapers this morning that I read, it was a poll that said many teens feel hopeless, and it talks about how roughly 15% of teens in the United States feel that they're going to die young. And this really floored me because I know that feeling of hopelessness from my own teenage years. I was diagnosed with diabetes at the age of 8, and I talk in the book about how that colored many of my early decisions in life. And I thought that feeling of hopelessness was largely because I had a chronic medical condition. And so to see this article not once but twice today really made me sit up and pay attention. And I think what our very simple parenting style does is it the affirmation aspect of it would not lead a child to feel hopeless. In fact, it would have the opposite effect of leading a child to feel because they've been affirmed throughout their life in an intelligent way. This isn't just fawning over every, you know, step that the child takes or every new accomplishment, you know, being lavish in your praise, but they've been affirmed for being who they are. They've been helped to develop into the person that they truly are, as opposed to some parents, I think, already have an idea of who they want their children to be when they arrive, and that may not be the person that the child is supposed to be, you know?
What are the signs that a parent is doing this right?
The signs for me were that my parenting with my children was largely something I enjoyed. I was able to find a way to relate with them and be their parent and guide them in a way where we could both feel that it wasn't antagonistic. It was more being on the same side. So I think that right from the get-go, I wanted to set up a situation where there wasn't any and so as possible.
I think there's a second answer to your question too, Carol, and I'll just address it briefly. I think you can see children who have been exposed to this kind of parenting. And the first line of the introduction of the book is millions of people raise great kids. We're not the only people who have ever done this. But when I began to feel like we had done this right was 6 or 8 years ago when our sons both began to receive a lot of praise from teachers and other parents and friends of ours and family members who were actually the people who encouraged us to write this book because they seemed to have a confidence about who they were and their ability to relate and interact with anyone. I mean, they were never fazed when at dinner at our house we'd invite friends over and those friends would be people our age or older. They were capable of conversing with anyone. They were never fazed by the gay men and women who are friends of their parents. That sort of stuff never caused them any pause whatsoever. They accepted people for who they were and sort of in return wanted to be accepted for who they were, and they were comfortable with who they were.
Rod, you're talking about the outcome, what you can see as a result of the parenting you did, and congratulations. But parenting was by far the hardest thing I ever attempted. I was not good at it. It's just hard. So give advice to parents. Give me the simplest formula you could give me for producing a yes child.
I would say that the first thing is to lead with communication. From a very early age, talk to your children in a way that invites their response and involves them in a dialogue. I think one of the problems that a lot of families have is that the dynamic within the family hasn't been established in the way that we talk about in our book. And I think parents really need to communicate in a very sincere, honest, straightforward relationship, or rather way, with their children from very early on in that child's age, and to maintain that and to have honest communication with your children throughout their entire lives in your household. No one does this perfectly, and I would reserve judgment about your parenting until that great day when I meet your daughter, Carol, because I'm already a huge fan of hers, and I think you might be being a little hard on yourself. I agree with you that parenting is a very hard thing to do, but the subhead of our book is a simple guide for raising great kids. What we found when we went to write on this subject was that the things we did weren't earth-shattering. They weren't these brilliant aha moments. They were things that we had intuitively done because it was treating our children in a manner in which we all like to be treated, with respect and acknowledging that they have opinions that might be different from our own. But I would be remiss if I led anyone ever to think that Marcy and I were some sort of perfect parents. We simply were not. We went through periods of horrendous stress, like every family goes through and like many families are going through right now. But you have to also forgive yourself for not being a perfect parent on those occasions when you are imperfect, and not beat yourself up for it. And also, I talk in the book about apologizing to my oldest son. There was a time when he was doing something very important in his high school, after school efforts, and it completely escaped Marcy and me. I volunteered an apology to him in this book because I felt that one was owed, and I wanted other parents to see that you can apologize to your children when something is done badly or when something gets by you. And I think that's actually a really good example to give, because I think people have lost sight of the fact that sometimes a simple apology goes a long way towards smoothing out rough waters. And I think you know, the art of apologizing in a very straightforward, simple fashion has fallen by the wayside.
Marcy, your sons are how old now?
20 and 23.
What do they think about this book?
They're a bit distanced from it, especially our older son. Both of them, I mean, I asked them both what specific questions to kind of think about. The thing that really both of them wrote about was an idea of not understanding the concept of being grounded, because it just wasn't something that we did in our household. And the other one was that Charlie, our younger son, spoke about going to college and, you know, having this roommate that he just loves and thinks is so cool, and then his parents came to visit and all of a sudden the roommate turned into this other person, and he was, you know, bickering with his parents and talking to them really disdainfully, and it really struck him because it made him aware that is not the kind of relationship that he has with us, and that he's glad he doesn't.
I'm curious, you talked about no grounding as an example. What did you use for punishment?
You know, I experimented. From the time when they were little, I tried things like the timeout, and I talk about in the book a little bit of the concept of meaning what you say, and I give the example of, like, you're riding in the car on a, you know, going on a 45-minute trip or something, and the kids are in the back, and they're strapped in their seats, but they're still wreaking havoc, and saying, be quiet and get along, or I'm going to stop the car, and then having to stop the car and actually doing it.
We never physically disciplined our children, but we did try waterboarding before it came back in fashion.
That's terrible. That's a bad joke. In the book, you talk about creating your own family culture. Describe a family culture and how a family goes about establishing a family culture.
That's actually one of the three essentials that we identified, because we think that we're also constantly inundated and bombarded by culture and communication these days. And one of the things that we discovered very early on was that there were things on television that we wouldn't have readily invited into our home. And so we wanted to filter those things out as best we could. And we wanted to build a family culture that was reflective of our values, and which are kind, gentle, loving, calm. I mean, that was the mantra that Marcy came up with that became kind of the center piece of our family culture. And if you don't set out to do that deliberately, you may not do that. And so you have to, I think, and Marcy and I found, really be deliberative about what are the things that you want represented in your house. And in our house, it was honesty and openness and art and music and joy. And so those were the things that we tried to manifest, and things that weren't a part of that, we tried to keep out of our house. We didn't want to invite in things that were counter to the message that we were trying to convey as a family.
Rod, I can't help but think about the parallels between your family's attempt to create a culture and the larger issue that you've worked on so hard, that is the creative culture of cities. You helped launch the creative class movement worldwide, and that got linked very closely to a creative cities movement. That movement, rightly or wrongly, has been focused mostly on young adults. Do you think there are any conflicts between cities that serve young adults well and cities that serve families with children well?
My experience is that there really aren't cities that do one and not the other. What I found in my extensive travels and the work I've done with you and Florida and, you know, the other leading proponents of the whole creative cities movement, I think there are cities that by and large get it and are happy to have young people and happy to have young families. And then there are cities that somehow feel threatened by that, maybe because they are principally made up of older demographic, an aging population, and young people have sort of always threatened that particular demographic, I think. But I'm not sure. I mean, maybe you're thinking of one in particular, but I'm not sure I could tell you a city that is attractive to young, sort of just out of college people, and not also attractive to young families, because one very rapidly becomes the next. And I'm not aware of a divide there. Is there something that you're thinking of particularly?
No, I'm just wondering. I think that cities have worked so hard to attract 25 to 34 year old singles, and I think there is a bit of a different job to be done if one is to keep them through their childbearing years. So it's and child raising years. So I'm just wondering what you're seeing on that front. But sticking on that subject just for another minute, you and Marcy created a family culture, and you say it was built on your values of kind, gentle, loving, calm, and that you worked hard to keep things out of your home that didn't reflect those values, and that makes a lot of sense. Again, sort of extending that into the city, do you think, and using your experience, Rod, with the Creative Cities movement, I'm just curious how intentional you believe a city can be about reflecting a certain set of values and keeping certain values out.
The thing that always comes to mind to me about a city that has done this superbly well is Chicago. And the thing that I love about Chicago, the reason it was always one of our favorite cities when I was doing my work with Florida, is that the mayor there is so tuned in, and as a result, the whole surrounding apparatus and infrastructure of the mayor is so tuned in to making Chicago a city that works for everyone, not just young people, not just young people with families, but, you know, the people who've been living in Chicago and working in Chicago all their lives. And it's one of the reasons why I think Chicago has the highest level of satisfaction per populace of any city in the country. And I think there are a myriad of examples of cities that haven't done that well, and I don't particularly want to name any of them because I think a lot of them are struggling with how to turn that particular perception around. But I think Chicago is just a great example of a city that works for everyone at every age. I remember sitting down, it was at the Chicago Blues Festival two summers ago, and I remember sitting at the fountain in Millennium Park, and for people who haven't been there, this is this fabulous fountain that's constructed out of two walls, maybe at a distance of about 25 or 30 yards apart, two massive walls that are made of glass brick and have video projections going on inside of them. And at periods in this projection, they squirt water out of people's mouths in these projections. And it creates just the greatest playground for young kids. And I was watching the families who gathered there with their young children, and they were of every description. They were from every neighborhood in Chicago, undoubtedly. And it wasn't like it was built only for yuppies. You know, it was built for everyone. And there were grandparents there, and it was just so much fun watching this summer playground with this tremendous water art sculpture piece at work. And I thought, what a great analogy for Chicago writ large. I think everything that is done there is really done to engage the entire population of Chicago in the city experience, that really rich urban experience that Chicago offers.
Let me ask you both for one final and short answer, and that is, what do you want readers to walk away from your book with? Give me the one thing that you want to make sure they learn from your book.
I did another interview with this was about 2 or 3 weeks ago, and Marcy couldn't make that interview. And the woman who was interviewing me at the end, when she was sort of wrapping up, said, you know, this is really great. She said, my partner and I have been going back and forth about whether we want to have children or not have children. And she said, until I read your book, I had no idea that this could be done the way you describe it being done. I thought having a child was going to be, you know, this horrific experience for everyone, like it was for my partner and me when we were little. And so I think if there's one thing that we want, it's the idea that anyone can do this at any time within their family. You don't have to start from the moment your child is born. I mean, we had another woman who did an endorsement for the book, because we met her at a speaking event that we did, and she called me a couple days later and said, you know, I liked your book. I don't know that there was much in it that I wasn't already doing. And then she went on to name 5 or 6 things that she got as takeaways from the book. So she had children that were 14 and 12. And, you know, going into the teenage years, it's really important to have that the communication established that we talk about.
And Marcy, what would your answer be?
My answer would be that it's possible to create the family that you want to have, and to have an experience as a family that you want to have, that if you want to have a loving, positive, good relationship with your kids all through their life, then you can do it.
I love that sentiment. Marcy, Rod, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Rod and Marcy Franz are parents of Max and Charlie and the authors of The Yes Child. There's more information on the book on our website, smartcityradio.com. Finally this week, sticks and stones may break our bones, but our City Views commentator Walker Smith says words can be even more powerful.
We are what we say we are, so it matters how we talk to ourselves and to one another. I have always been fascinated by the power with which words affect people. I think I get this from being born with a dominant gene for loquaciousness. My 9th grade math teacher figured the best way to shut me up was to recommend that I go see the 11th grade chemistry teacher who coached our high school debating team. Suddenly, I had a socially acceptable outlet for my big fat mouth. One of the necessities of debating is arguing both sides of an issue. You argue pro and con about an equal number of times over the course of a tournament. So words became like Play-Doh to me. I could mold them into whatever shape best fit the moment. But this isn't how most of us view the words we read, hear, or say. We think of words as sacred. We mean what we say, and we expect that others do too. We take people at their word. English poet Rudyard Kipling, an exquisite craftsman of words himself, said once that words are the most powerful drug used by mankind. We use words to define how we think of ourselves, and we can become overly intoxicated with ourselves or unnecessarily hurtful to others because of the words we use. The genius of the much maligned political correctness phenomenon is a recognition of this. It matters whether we say crippled or special needs, Negro or African American, dumb or mute, homo or gay, man or humankind, alternative energy or renewable energy, fat or full-figured. And if this sounds just too cloyingly liberal to you, I mean too cloyingly progressive to you, then pay heed instead to conservative Republican wordsmith Frank Lutz, the man who coined the term death tax for estate tax and the phrase exploring for energy for drilling for oil. He entitled his recent book Words That Work, and it was all about shaping perceptions by shaping words. When I finally got to the real world after too many inbred years of debating, I had to teach myself to be more fastidious with my words and more cognizant of the reality of what I say. Nowadays, I am ultra-sensitive to both the pernicious and the profound power of words. Perhaps I'm overthinking this, but I worry that by and large we have forgotten respect for others in our partisan political speak, and that we have all but abandoned any sense of balance and reserve in our self-congratulatory bluster. The tenor of our time seems to me to be shrill to the point of sophistry. That means fallacious. That means a lie. That means burying the truth behind a facade of carefully worded fictions. And that means a dearth of empathy for others, or for any attempt to use words to bring all of us together. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is the president of Yankelevich Monitor, a trend service of the Futures Company. He joins us each week from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. That's it for this week's show, but there's more Smart City if you go to our website, smartcityradio.com. You can listen to archive shows, subscribe to our podcast, or sign up for our weekly newsletter. You can also send us your questions, your comments, your kudos, or complaints by clicking on the contact button or sending an email to questions@smartcityradio.com. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer, engineer, and proud uncle. I'm Carol Coletta.